morning, Weird West Radio contains adult language and discussions. If you're easily offended, do not continue to listen.
See, in this world, there's two kinds of people, my friend. Those with loaded guns, and those who dig. You dig.
I want you to understand how good a woman your mama was. She took Colton Briggs, the coldest killer that I've ever met, and she turned him into a family man.
My mama's dead now.
Coming in one way or another.
Tell me the names of the men who did this.
As long as that little girl is alive, there's no room for vengeance.
You're protecting a killer.
From another killer.
Can you teach me how to shoot?
All right, hello. Welcome back, everyone, to Weird West Radio, Rayman Digital's exclusive Western podcast where we talk about all things Western related. All right, so in this particular episode today, hello, welcome, David.
Hello, everybody.
It's been a while since we have sat in the studio to talk about a Western film, just about a year. We took a year off, but that just means that we have a lot planned for 2026, yes. Starting with a Nicolas Cage series of discussions. So any Western film that features Nicolas Cage, we're going to try to get into it. There has been a surprising uptick of Nicolas Cage Westerns of late.
Yeah, shockingly.
Some aren't very great
because it's Nicolas Cage.
Some are pretty good. Today, we're going to be talking about The Old Way. The Old Way is a 2023 American Western film directed by Brett Donahue from a screenplay by Carl W. Lucas and starring Nicolas Cage as a retired gunman on a mission to find the outlaws who killed his wife. Now, the film was originally released by Saban Films on January 6, 2023, and like many Cage films, received mixed reviews from critics. That's not a surprise, right, Dave? Some people don't seem to fully understand the Cageisms, and oftentimes they shun them, or they run away, or they offer a very critical appraisal of the movie, in which Nicolas Cage is acting very Cage-ish.
That's a way of saying it.
Yeah, so the synopsis, the official synopsis, an old gunslinger and his daughter must face the consequences of his past when the son of a man he murdered years ago arrives to take his revenge. Now, if you are new to the podcast, you can find most of our past episodes wherever you listen to podcasts. Just search Weird West Radio. If you're an Apple Podcast user, please be sure to leave us a review and rate the podcast. Okay, so Nicolas Cage films are, at this point in his career, unpredictable.
Yes.
At best.
Much like Nicolas Cage.
That's true. Cage, David, is an actor who I would say demands a unique type of audience. One that appreciates or at least has fallen in love with his signature Cageisms.
Yes.
That said, Cage is a true acting talent whose dedication to his craft, in my opinion, brings a singular intensity and depth to each role, which ultimately leaves audiences captivated by his range. And I emphasize range because Nicolas Cage has immense range.
Yes.
You could throw almost any role at him and he can handle it. Now, I think the newer generation enjoys Cage films, but they think that, sure, that he is just this guy, that he's typecast as this odd, awkward character with quirks, right?
In a lot of ways, I think that the newer generation of like movie fans out there look at Nicolas Cage as we would look at William Shatner. Earlier, Shatner's a fantastic actor if you look at his earliest works. I mean, you can tell he is a actor's actor. It's only till later that he starts getting this reputation as an actor with fans that you see Shatnerisms. Nowadays, you see that with Nicolas Cage. A lot of fans basically like, I think it's because due to social media and the power of the generation of like memetic culture, you have Nicolas Cage as one of those people that has been typecasted into that role for this newer generation, where it's like, you know, people think of Nicolas Cage, they think of his facial expressions, his outlandish, you know, reactions. And back in the day, we would just basically say, no, he's just method acting.
Yeah. And maybe typecast isn't the best way to describe him, because I think he is, and I believe, David, your comparison to William Shatner is spot on, because just like William Shatner, Nicolas Cage is very aware of what he's doing.
Yes.
It's not like there's some aloof morons who have no idea that people are laughing at them for some of their performances. They're in on the joke. They get it. They're doing it because they enjoy it. They enjoy hamming it up. Now, there are times when Nicolas Cage obviously overhams it up, and that may not be his fault. That may be the actual director of whatever film it may be's fault, right?
Yes.
But that's not to say Nicolas Cage is ever sucky in a movie. His skill always comes through. He is very dedicated to whatever role he takes on. And that's why I always appreciate him as a talent, because even the most shittiest of movies, the thing you can point to and say, well, that part's good, it's always him.
Yes.
It's always Nicolas Cage. I mean, his obvious affection for films and his craft make it difficult to separate Nicolas Cage at times from the roles he plays, much like a renowned artist whose, you know, personal, you know, eccentricities overshadow the very works that made them famous. Mm-hmm. So in a way, Cage has become a living canvas. You know, his performances are less about the films themselves and more about the unique imprint of his identity, I guess, is a more formal way of saying what we've been talking about. You know, kind of like a force of nature that transcends any one character. Now, the Old Way's appeal is Cage's dire, morose presence that fuels the narrative's revenge plot. And this is what makes it difficult at times to view the overall piece unconstrained by Cage's dominant on-screen persona, right? However, a film like The Old Way, written and directed as it is, places Cage not just as the subject, but as the very engine driving the emotional tension, which makes his larger than life presence an actual integral part of the storytelling rather than a mere distraction.
Especially when you put it into context with I'm not saying that Brett Donahue is a rookie director, but like when you're dealing with a lower level director, when with their filmography,
less experienced
yeah, director, right?
Mm-hmm.
An actor like Nicolas Cage can absolutely overwhelm a director like that, because a director will look at that and almost use that actor as like a crutch. And instead of getting a balanced film, you more or less get a showcase of one actor. And that's what happens sometimes with a Nicolas Cage film. A Nicolas Cage film is kind of like, I always look at it now and say, okay, what is he doing? Who is he working with? And who are the actors around him?
That's a good point, David. It seems like if you look at Nicolas Cage's earlier work, which is exceptional in almost every way, the directors he was working with were not just more experienced necessarily. It's not in it, my little rationale here is not necessarily about experience, but if you look at the names of the directors that directed those early films, they're strong personalities.
Yes.
I would even say several of them are considered auteurs. They have a strong style. They have a strong sense of purpose. They know what they're going to do before they even walk on set. Mm-hmm. They have their signature. They know exactly how things are going to be executed. If you look at Nicolas Cage's latter half of his career up until contemporary times, he's working with far less known directors.
Yes.
Directors who I would not necessarily characterize as an auteur. And because of that, his personality becomes the more dominant rather than, or I should say, his signature becomes the more dominant than the signature of the director.
That's why I honestly think his run recently in the horror genre was amazing, because all the films that he was doing was essentially putting Nicolas Cage out of his comfort zone. He was in a genre that he wasn't used to. So that's why that run of horror films, a lot of people point to that and say, oh, that's where Nicolas Cage, his resurgence this recent times has come from, is those horror films. And I basically point to it, say, because he had to work out of his comfort zone. He had to work with directors that were comfortable in the horror genre and came in with a set blueprint and basically showed Nicolas Cage, hey, this is what we're going to do. We're going to have you work in the script, in the concept, in within the idea. We don't want you to blow past the concept. And in doing so, that's where you pull the best out of Nicolas Cage. And why I've always stated Nicolas Cage is one of the greatest actors of this newer timeline.
Are we in alternate realities? I like that.
But like he's one of those newer actors, and I hate saying that
newer. Or you mean just he's one of the actors working in contemporary times?
Contemporary times.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a better way of putting it, is like he's one of the actors.
He's worked in various eras. Most actors have a career of maybe 8 years.
Because I don't consider Nicolas Cage a classic actor. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like he's not, say for example, a Robert Redford. Or even a Jack Nicholson. He's after that.
He's a Nicolas Cage.
He's a Nicolas Cage. And that's the thing about Nick Cage, is like when you actually watch one of his films, even recently, he's one of those actors that's still out there that I'm like going, yeah, people see. It's one of those things that me and you have talked about where we don't have movies that are headlined by actors. You know what I mean? Like a Tom Cruise film, some of the older actors.
We don't have a lot of star power.
Star power.
Yeah. Yeah, I know what you're saying.
And like Nicolas Cage is one of those guys that basically still has that a little bit.
He is a star without the power, just because he's a star with gravitas. Star power is typically a phrase that describes someone's ability to bring in a box office, to put asses in seats. And unfortunately, we're just in a time where there really isn't that one actor anymore. Even Tom Cruise, who does demand an audience, you know, his mere presence in a movie does demand an audience at times, but he's one of one at this point in time where he packs the seats.
Yes.
But that's also reliant on the actual film he's in. Yes. So that's not to say anything bad about Nicolas Cage per se, but if you look at his career over the last 10 years, he has a string of films. I would say 70% of them are not bad. Starting with Mandy, I mean, all the way up to The Pig, in 2021, which is a fantastic movie that I did not expect to even be merely as good as it was.
Yes.
And then we have The Old Way, which is an imperfect Western, but actually a very morally relevant picture. It's interesting in how it excavates and fleshes out morality in a family setting, which we're going to get into that because that's something that, in fact, that's probably the greatest element of this movie. In fact, that is the movie. If you were to give someone, offer someone a tight consensus or premise for this movie, you would have to throw in the moral dimensions, which is how our characters are fleshed out through those moral explanations. But David, before we get into that, let's just dig right into your initial thoughts on this movie specifically.
My initial thoughts when you first brought this film to me to see if I'd be interested in doing it, I basically, as soon as I saw Nicolas Cage, I'm like going, yes, I need to cover this solely because of him, but also because, like, again, this is something that Nicolas Cage was going into a genre that you don't normally see him in. And in those scenarios, he's had some really good success where it's like, okay, he's going out of his comfort zone. He's going into different genres and it's working. If he could do a Western with Nicolas Cage energy, that would be fantastic.
Yeah.
It'd be kind of like one of those dream movies that I would think in a director's hands, the right director's hands, you could come up with some of the most amazing, memorable, memeable scenes. Because it's Nicolas Cage. Nicolas Cage is a cowboy.
Surprisingly, and I say surprisingly, I don't know why, David. Maybe I'm a victim of herd consensus when it comes to Nicolas Cage, but I was surprised that I enjoyed this movie as much as I did. We're in an era where there's a lot of Westerns coming out and they're being produced by people that don't really understand the Western genre. You know, hey, here's a cowboy hat and some boots. That's a Western, right? That makes a Western. No, it doesn't. But that's not the case with this movie. This movie gets it right. But what makes The Old Way more than just a simple run-of-the-mill revenge Western is not necessarily its plot. You know, revenge stories are a staple of the genre. I think most of us can agree with that. But rather than being simply a revenge film, the film's emotional and moral framework is really what makes the film shine. At its core, this is a story about what holds a family and a person together. And how the absence of that stabilizing force can unravel not only relationships, but identity itself. You know, where The Old Way, for example, distinguishes itself isn't in its revenge setup necessarily. Vengeance is practically a required ingredient in any Western. It's in how the film frames the revenge as a moral regression rather than catharsis. So some people may think, David, well, that sounds awfully similar to Unforgiven.
Yes.
You know, the character in Unforgiven, Clint Eastwood's character, became a better human upon meeting his future wife, correct?
Yes.
That was the overall gist
that you get in the end.
This takes that idea and fleshes it out and connects it to not just a desire to do good for your wife and your family, but a moral change, that there's something special about this character's wife that aids him in understanding morality, becoming in touch with emotion and humanity. So it's a far deeper movie in that regard.
Yes.
So you have Nicolas Cage's character, Colton Briggs, prior to meeting Ruth, it's depicted almost as a moral void, right?
Yes.
An efficient killer whose actions are driven by impulse, skill, and emotional detachment. He's kind of a psychopath.
He is.
Rather than having any type of guiding principle. Now, the story does strongly suggest that Colton's transformation into a civilized, family-oriented man wasn't due to a natural evolution, but rather the influence of Ruth, who acted as his ethical, I guess you could say ballast is probably a good word for that. She centered him.
Yeah.
Gave him a moral North Star and effectively humanized a man who was otherwise drifting through life, governed by violence and instinct.
Yes.
So when she dies in the movie, her death is not simply the inciting event or inciting incident. It is the removal of the thing that kept him human.
Exactly.
That's what makes this movie unique.
And that's what I thought was really interesting about it, because when you actually watch the film and you think about like the little details of this film, like especially the title, The Old Way, is where you begin to realize the concept of this film is so well thought out, because like, essentially, I'm glad you brought up the whole idea of the Unforgiven aspect, because that is one of the strengths of Unforgiven, is in the very end, Clint Eastwood character, while he's still, you know, that murderer that basically literally threatens a town that he's going to come in and slaughter all of them if they don't treat his friend's body right.
Yeah. His wasn't a moral change.
Yeah.
It was simply, I'm going to put my killing on hold.
On hold.
I'm going to put it on the shelf because my wife doesn't like it and I want to do good by her.
And we only get that as a blurb in the very, very end. Here in The Old Way, it's almost like the scriptwriter and the director said, you know what, let's take that concept and just like what you said, let's flesh it out. Let's make it the core centerpiece of our story.
And we're not saying... So please, listeners, I don't want to receive hate mail saying, how dare you say The Old Way is better than Unforgiven? And That's not what we're saying.
That's not what we're saying.
Unforgiven is a superb, superior movie in almost every way. We're just saying where the movies deviate.
Yes.
And that in its deviation, it becomes unique, The Old Way. And in its uniqueness is also its strength.
Exactly. And that's the thing about this film is like, I've seen online that people just bash this film because a lot of people just don't understand what this film is supposed to be. And I think that that falls on the director himself. If you were to say that there are any weakness in the film, mm-hmm. it's probably the director, because like a lot of people aren't like me and you who will cut into the details and actually say, look at all these concepts they're playing with.
Yeah.
This is actually really good. This is a good idea. If someone approached any filmmaker and said, here's my concepts and here's my ideas of this film, 90% of filmmakers would look at it and go, okay, let's do it. This looks good. Because if you look at the bones of The Old Way, this is why Nicolas Cage got brought in, or you got Nicolas Cage, because I guarantee you, he probably looked at this and said, okay, this looks interesting. This looks to be like a challenge.
Yeah.
And that's what brought him in. The problem is kind of like,
they probably had to cut Crafty a couple of days in order to afford Cage. I would do it. I'm like, hey guys, we're just going to have Del Taco today for the next 2 or 3 days because we need to afford Cage.
Mr. Cage.
So do we want to do a movie with Cage or do a movie where we're all fat and fed?
We're going to do a movie with Cage.
Yeah. Here's your Del Taco. Now shut the fuck up.
But that's ultimately what I think is.
I know that whole little bit, David, was oddly specific. And you know why.
I know why. And I'm sure a lot of our longtime listeners know why. But like, I think that's what is sad about this movie is because it gets overlooked. Because like, there's a lot of really great ideas and concepts within this film that I'm like going, if it were handled by just a little bit more of a seasoned crew, you still have Nicolas Cage. You probably could keep the cast, but if the production crew was just a little bit more seasoned, I think you would have had a film much like a lot of Cage's recent hits.
Yeah.
Like The Pig.
Yeah.
Because like you look at films like that and it's just basically, it really comes down to execution and using Nicolas Cage to his limit.
Well, if you have a director, I like how you say to his limit, because I don't think there's a limit to Cage though, Dave.
There's no limit, but there's a limit to a director.
There you go. I think that's where a good director comes in. Mm-hmm. They say, listen, Cage, give me everything you possibly can, and I will tell you when to stop. But oftentimes, see, that's the difference between a good director and a bad director. Let your actor perform, let him do what he wants, and then you offer him some guidance to say, let's bring it down a bit. You know, but if you have a director who's starstruck, which often happens on indie pictures, you're not going to be able to contain the Cage-isms. But in this movie, I feel like the director, the writer, as well as Cage, were all on the same page.
That's the key.
Yeah.
You really get the sense that Nicolas Cage was at least on the same page with them.
I think they all understood that they were going to be telling less of a revenge tale and more of a moral tale.
Yes.
Because just like we were talking about with Colton Briggs, you know, Nicolas Cage's character needing that moral compass, his wife, the same thing can be said about the entire family dynamic, including the daughter. So Brooke, which I believe is the name of the daughter, reflects her father's earlier emotional state.
Yeah.
You know, she displays the same eerie calmness, detachment, and lack of innate empathy that Colton once possessed. In fact, I would say there, if I remember correctly, there was one of the more chilling and thematically important elements of the film is how Brooke observes violence with a clinical curiosity rather than fear or moral judgment. So she's not shocked by death. She wants to understand it. So where Colton found his moral compass through Ruth, Brooke loses hers when Ruth, her mother, is taken away. Mm-hmm. Her arc becomes less about vengeance and more about emotional direction, whether she will follow her father's old path of cold-blooded nihilism or find something that replaces the moral warmth her mother provided. And this, David, is what creates a dynamic where both father and daughter are essentially adrift, mirroring one another at different stages of life. So you have Colton, who reverts to the killer he once was. Brooke risks becoming the same version without ever having known anything else.
Mm-hmm.
So now what you get is a story about generational violence. As well now, on top of that,
because especially when you get to the end.
Yeah. So this movie is operating on various moral registers, emotional dynamics. The strength of the movie is this idea that without Ruth, without the mother, the Briggs family becomes a closed loop of emotional numbness and violence.
And violence, yes.
So the tragedy in the film's most interesting moral dimensions is that the only person capable of preventing that outcome is the very person whose loss triggered it. It's a no-win situation.
Yeah, exactly. It really does become like one of those really good classic revenge tales where when the main, quote-unquote, main character of a revenge tale loses that one person, you know for a fact that in the end, the character must die. That's the whole thing about revenge tales. A person's going to go out guns a-blazing. It's one of those things that I've always liked because out of Hong Kong cinema, revenge tales are everywhere. That's what kung fu movies are based on, is revenge tales. And like, it's one of those things in revenge tales where it's kind of like you start the film With the inciting incident, and then the revenge takes place throughout the entire film. But never once do we lose track of the fact that we sympathize with the revenge taker. Like, you have to actually...
But it's not like... This is where the movie kind of subverts those revenge film expectations, because whereas a revenge picture feeds into the audience's desire for that vengeance. We empathize. We are right there with this individual. It's kind of the opposite. We don't want him to lose himself. Now that we understand what's at stake, that it's not just about him.
Yes.
It's his daughter as well. It changes the audience's desires for vengeance. So where I guess you can say the old way subverts the traditional revenge narrative, right? That's what it does, right? With the morality aspects. It's not justice that motivates Colton. It's a return to familiarity.
Yes.
The only way he knows how to exist before Ruth taught him otherwise. So the pursuit of revenge is not about closure, but regression.
Yes.
Which is a very sad tale that is a sad reality.
Yeah. And just like what you said, you add that. And the thing about the old way is like there's so many layers going on because you take that concept and then you throw in the daughter. Where it's like you compound the tragedy because it's and just like what you mentioned, it's an endless loop of violence that essentially Colton creates himself.
David, yes, that's what I was going to say. You're right, because even the way this revenge saga was told, the antagonists are not really villains.
Yes.
They're more just catalysts.
Well, think about it.
Because the enemy, really, the villain or the true antagonist is the loss of morality itself.
Because if you even think of like the antagonist, James McAllister has every right to want to go kill Colton.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because like the whole movie starts with Colton killing James's, I think it's his
His father. And so, his father deserved, I mean, his father was kind of a piece of shit.
But still, it's still his father.
Yeah. And so, he was murdered in a very callous, cold fashion.
Yeah, because it's Nicolas Cage.
Yeah. Well, didn't he twirl his gun and then stop right before he shot him to take like a drag off a cigarette?
Yes.
And then
he did it nonchalantly too, in front of James, who's a child at that point.
Yeah.
And it's like you realize this cycle of vengeance starts with Colton killing James's father, transfers to James, then goes to his daughter. And then it's like this is what makes revenge tales so awesome, because the overall message in revenge tales is revenge is a constant cycle. You cannot break the cycle.
Okay. Yes. Typically, yes. But in this movie, David, do you think some of the questions that we're posing were, and I have two of them written out because I thought they were key, and I want to get your response on this. So the film seems to be using everything we've been talking about, you know, the idea of the loss of morality. The antagonists are less villains and more catalysts, and the actual antagonist is the loss of morality itself. So the film uses this mirroring to pose a few key thematic questions. At least it seemed that way to me. If a person's morality is entirely dependent on another human being, did they ever truly change, or were they merely borrowing someone else's virtue? And to parallel that, before you answer, is Brooke destined to inherit her father's sins, or can she forge her own moral identity? Do you see how those questions might have been posed?
Yes, especially with the ending. I mean, the ending itself, the ending scenes with Brooke and I think his name was Jensen.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
You're
talking about the that other great actor that we get in that movie, Abraham. No. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Dave.
But
like, I'll find the name.
The two characters in the very end, Jarrett. That's what my notes were like saying, like,
yeah, the guy from Justified. Yeah.
And like him and Brooke in the very end, you kind of get the sense that the question, like you were posing, is Brooke going to continue her father's sins? or is she going to do forge another path? The beautiful thing about that ending, I felt, was like you could say either. She could end it, or she could really continue it. And that's honestly the best way I feel you can end a revenge tale.
Yeah.
You never want to actually give your audience all the answers. You want the audience to come up with their own answers. And I think that's where great endings to spaghetti westerns come from, really. When they have that ambiguity where it's like, okay, this just happens. And
you mean things that are common in spaghetti westerns?
Yeah.
Where
it's like a really great example is like,
not that this movie is a spaghetti western, has that in common with,
but it has that common. It has that, I guess you could say that I don't want to use the word stereotype, but basically that type of,
the archetype. Yeah.
It has that type of archetype that basically is very reminiscent of some other spaghetti westerns that me and you have covered on this on this station, where it's like, okay, you have an ending where it's like you make up the ending, not the director.
Yes, because with this film, the film does not offer a comforting answer. Mm-mm. At all. Instead, it leaves the audience with a bit of an uneasy understanding that redemption is fragile, mm-hmm. and morality is simply circumstantial, and generational trauma is far more than cyclical. It's far more cyclical, I should say, than what's the word I'm looking for?
Than
cathartic. Yeah. So, which I think is if I was being, you know, a moralist myself here, I think that's a far better message than typical revenge films, mm-hmm. because typically revenge films, that is catharsis for many people. We're like, yes,
yes,
yes. This is different. This isn't about feeding into that bloodlust that many of us have when we're watching revenge films. This is more of, hey guys, is this really what we want for this child?
Well, that's the thing. Yeah. I love the performance of Cage in this, because normally when you watch a Nicolas Cage film, you're rooting for the character of Nicolas Cage. You're rooting for him.
Yeah.
Instead,
you want him to make the right moral decision for his daughter's
well-being.
For his daughter's well-being, yeah.
But here's the thing. You look at Colton Briggs, and throughout the entire movie, I always get the sense Colton's never going to make this choice. Like, especially when, I think it's in the middle of the film where he's told by his old friend, do not go after James because, you know, don't go for revenge. Right. And what does Colton do? It's kind of obvious. He's going for revenge. He doesn't care.
You know, in some ways it seems like, because obviously in reality, we don't lose morality and we don't gain morality just because we met someone. I mean, this is a fictionalized take on the dimensions of morality. However, that being said, I forgot the name of it, but there is a type of psychological state where your morality is turned down.
Yes.
So for example, your emotions, your empathy, your emotional intelligence is at a very low volume.
Yeah.
And then there's certain times. It's not that it's not there. It's just like, it's kind of like you hear it. It's not that it's not important, but its priorities are down here.
And you know what's amazing is kind of like a movie like this, giving this message in today's world.
Where everyone's morality is turned down,
is amazing to me. And I honestly think that's why people reviewed this movie so badly. Because the message here is not what the audience wants to hear. It isn't what we all want to hear, which is we're all good people. No, we're actually at a point when basically if you look at today's world, look at the news, look at how everyone is reacting to each other, our level of morality is turned down. When we make excuses for immoral acts, let's just say that. When we make excuses for immoral acts and justify them, it doesn't remove the fact that it's an immoral act. And I think that that basically is what this movie also is saying in one of its layers, is kind of like, yeah, we understand why Colton wants to kill these guys. They stabbed his wife and killed her brutally. It was a brutal death. And like,
it was fucking brutal.
It was brutal. And it was against a person who's probably the most innocent character.
She was a lady.
Yeah. And just like we said, she is the moral compass of the entire film. And this gang just comes in, doesn't shoot her too. And I think that that was a really interesting choice to make sure that the director, I think the director and the screenwriter did this on purpose to stab her, because the idea of stabbing is more brutal than shooting someone. And it, that basically lowers the moral level that of audience, I think audience would go. They'd be go, oh my God, they killed her so brutally. Yeah, kill them all. Kill them all.
So Dave, everything we've been going over, we would both agree, is the strength of the movie.
It is.
It's the strength. It's its moral weight and what it's trying to say. It's theme. That's not to say the movie's perfect.
No.
So
by far, no.
If people are listening, they're like, oh, hell yeah, this is going to be, I'm going to go check this movie out. I do feel people should watch this movie, but just be warned that it is a movie littered with
issues.
It does have some issues. Not anything that takes you out of the movie. Nothing that makes you scratch your head and like, why the fuck did they do that? It doesn't suck, but there are issues, mostly in some of the casting choices, except for Nicolas Cage. The main three, Nick Searcy, I think his name is, the gentleman from Justified, who's just, his delivery is always spot on. You give him a line and that guy delivers. I think his name is Nick Searcy. Yeah, the guy that played Marshall Jarrett, as well as Ryan Armstrong, which is Brooke. And then Nicolas Cage, Colton Brooks. The three of them were top notch. They did a fantastic job. I couldn't ask for more. Everyone else, well, Ruth, the actress that played Ruth, Carrie Noop, I believe is how you say her last name. She was also just fine. Nearly everyone else I struggled with. But fortunately, they don't have a lot to do in the movie.
Yes.
The movie foregrounds those three characters I mentioned in such a way that when you do have to be exposed to another actor, it doesn't ruin things because the focus is on those three characters.
Yes.
The story, the narrative, the plot, it's all being propelled by those three characters. So even though some of the casting is less than stellar, it doesn't ruin the movie. Now, there's also some issues with some of the camera work.
Yes.
At times, the cinematography felt a little overexposed. Did you get that, Dave? Like, there are some day scenes that are just way too bright and sunny. There isn't enough contrast. It feels like it's less of a color grading issue, which is what you do in editing. And it feels more like they decided to shoot with an open lens and not scrim down or even use a silk to stop the sun.
Because everything looks
hot.
Hot.
And you can get that hot look and still scrim down your lights.
And that's the problem that I think is, for me, the things that affect this film is some of the execution bits with the visuals. Is the cinematography to me looked really flat because of that brightness. The example I always put is like the one thing that always took me out of a film, say like Indiana Jones and the Crystal Skull, was the overblown lights. Like,
it's not the monkeys.
It's not the monkeys.
It's not Shia LaBeouf swinging with the monkeys.
It's honestly how everything is lit too bright, because it's, there is a certain quality that you need to do in film that I think a lot of filmmakers forget. Lighting is important.
Yeah. And we've shot in the desert, you and I, plenty of times to know that you never just shoot raw in the desert.
Oh, hell no.
You have to have those giant 48 by silks. If you're lucky enough and you can afford it and your picture has a big enough budget, then get yourself one of those giant 100 buys.
Or if you have to, then cut in close. You have to cheapen it. If you have to be cheap, cheapen it and cut your shots in close, because that was one of the things that took me out sometimes.
And we're just guessing on some of those issues because we're not privy to exactly what they did in terms of cinematography. So we're only going based on our own experiences in order to interpret some of those visual issues we had, right?
Exactly. And here's the thing. Some of those visual issues we're pointing out does affect a audience psychologically.
Yeah, they may not get it.
They might not get it, but they're probably looking at it going, man, this looks terrible. Why is this bothering me so much?
Well, it's the difference between a big budget and a low budget picture. A low budget
fixture, yeah. And like that ultimately to me is where this film falters, is because I honestly feel that the cinematography and the visuals were definitely lacking. And also for me, the director seemed at certain scenes seemed out of his element, where it was like, okay, I get what you're trying to do. I get what you're trying to say. But again, you're leaning onto your actors too much. Like, I get it. It's Nicolas Cage. Let Nicolas Cage roll. However, when you have a actor like Brooke, the character of the actor who plays Brooke, you need to be really hands-on. And there's sometimes when I feel that the director just didn't do enough for her to actually bring out more polish to her performance. Like, she did fine. I thought
you're talking about the girl.
The girl.
See, I thought the girl was great.
I thought she did good. But there was always something, especially when you're in scenes with Nicolas Cage.
Well, you're dealing.
Cage is up here.
Well, yeah.
She was like down here.
Well, now, I wouldn't say that, but I do. If you're comparing her to Nicolas Cage, then yes, yeah. Nicolas Cage is fucking Nicolas Cage.
His volume's up here.
Yeah.
But here's the thing, though, Mike. It's up to the director at that point to kind of bring those actors up a bit.
Okay, I get your
point.
So
that they don't get overshadowed.
Yeah.
And that's the problem that I kind of started seeing, is like Nicolas Cage being Nicolas Cage and the director not really taking a hands-on approach and saying, okay, let's bring her up a little bit.
So you believe that some of the weaknesses had less to do with maybe money restraints, budget, and more to do with the director himself?
I think the execution. I think it's honestly execution.
Yeah.
And, you know, he didn't do a terrible job.
It's hard for me to say, David. I mean, I don't disagree with you. There are execution issues, which ultimately falls on the director's shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't a massive studio or a giant budget that would dictate major interference from a studio. So I would say, just from our own experience and in film, that this movie was probably his cut.
Yes.
Again, don't quote me on that. I'd have to verify before I say it with 100% absolute certainty. So yeah, David, I would be inclined to agree that ultimately the imperfections and the flaws of the movie do in fact fall on the director's shoulders. I don't always blame the director, especially on big budget movies. When you look at a film like, say, Jurassic Park, the recent one, let's say. I mean, you can argue that it's Gareth Edwards' fault, but also you can point to other films that he's done that are far better.
Yeah.
So then you say, well, it's obviously studio interference. It has to be. Why that movie was so bad. So with a movie like this, you don't really have those situations. So it's more than likely a directing issue.
A directing issue. And that's to be given. I mean, filmmaking is a process. It's about finding that happy balance that makes a great film, that makes your film good. because, and you know, I glanced at one point his filmography, and you can see that basically this guy, this director's kind of like less experienced. So he's going to make those fumbles that any of us would make in that scenario. Now, that's why when I looked at it, I'm like going, the concepts here are so good in a different director's hands. How much better would that film be? And that's ultimately why my criticism about it is like, I can visually see if the right director was doing this film, it would be much better.
Yeah. I would probably agree with that. Because even Lucas, Carl Lucas, the writer, even the script seemingly was fine.
Yeah.
There weren't those typical glaring, you know, writing issues. It does feel like if you had to blame something about some of those inadequacies, it would have to be the directing.
Yeah.
I think it's safe to say, David, that I did enjoy this movie. I do recommend that if you're a Western fan, you should check this out. It is a fun movie. And if you're looking for a new, fresh Western to watch on a Friday night, yeah, check it out. And I would give this a 68% on the RMD score. It's a solid film. It's fun, enjoyable, but far from perfect.
Yeah, I'm sitting just above you a little bit in when I watched this, because of the concepts I found were so interesting. It made me stay in my seat watching the film. I would give this a 70. This is a 70 film for me, where it's kind of like, it's not a bad film, and it's not like groundbreaking, but you can see the concepts could be groundbreaking.
I think the moral dimensions, I might say, I don't want to say groundbreaking. They are unique for a Western.
Yes.
So, David, we do have plans to continue our Nicolas Cage. We may do another two or three films. We're going to be, you know, let me pull up my list here of Cage movies. All right. Starting our year off right.
And Nicolas Cage has been a busy man.
Okay, so this is what we're going to do. We're going to do Butcher's Crossing next. And then we're going to do Brian Skiba's Gunslingers. And starring Stephen Dorff. And I say because we have to, is because Brian Skiba is a guy that we kind of, well, you more than I did, came up with.
Yes.
In the film community in the early, what, mid 2000s.
Yes.
Yeah. And the guy has carved himself out a career.
Absolutely.
Always making movies. I mean, working with Stephen Dorff, Heather Graham, and Nicolas Cage. And
Nicolas Cage.
That's a fun cast. So yeah, Nicolas Cage is what we're focusing on first. And then we're going to move over to the classic and iconic Randolph Scott. So we have things planned this year that's going to keep us busy. I want to thank everyone for listening. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Foresaid he be taken from such prison to a suitable and convenient place of execution within said county, and there be hanged by the neck till he be dead, dead, dead. Now, do you have anything to say, young man?
Yes, Your Honor, I do. You can go to hell. Hell, hell.